This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 12th of December 2010 here in Japan and the 11th of December 2010 in the United States, where I'm joined on the line once again by our regular monthly guest, whistleblower Lieutenant Eric Schein, who is available at martiallaw911.com and crossingtherubicon.org, as well as on In the Zone, a weekly program on republicbroadcasting.org every Saturday night at 9 p.m. Pacific, 12 midnight Eastern. And of course, listeners might know that I'm co-hosting that show, and it is available on the interviews tab of CorbettReport.com each week, but I suggest and encourage people to listen in live so they can phone in and get their voice in the mix as well. So Lieutenant Eric Schein, great to have you on the program as always. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, James. And you're talking live in about 3 hours and 20 minutes, right?
That's right. We are recording this. It's Sunday morning for me, and so in a couple of hours, we'll be on the air on Republic Broadcasting. So, again, I hope people are tuning into that and making use of the time that they can talk to both of us directly.
Cool. Well, and any of this may, this conversation or interview may transfer over into our live discussion on air.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, we haven't really talked about what we want to talk about this week. So I guess the question is, what is on your mind? What's on your plate right now?
I hate to say that, you know, my own case is, you know, first and foremost in my mind. And it's not just because it's my case. And I think people really need to understand that we live in a common law country. And that's one thing I think that escapes a lot of people, that, and it's kind of bizarre because that's what the Coast Guard, they're saying that I have not violated any law, rule, or regulation, and this goes to not only notice but due process, that if you're charged with anything, it's supposed to be for a violation of an existing law, rule, or regulation that has been enacted by Congress or the broad authority to some executive branch administration or agency has been granted by an act of Congress for them to create, say, rules, like within the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, or some other industry, to where Congress gives them a broad edict. You know, of course, they're supposed to make sure that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights apply, and all sorts of other laws that have been enacted, you know, from our onset there forward up until today, and make sure that all of that is incorporated in any rules that they make up. And first and foremost, any rules that they do make up should come almost from the language of laws themselves. But in a common law country, and in my own situation, they are using case precedents to charge me with. It's almost as if somebody was charged with murder and found guilty, rather than charging me with a violation of a law that existed on the books, like, say, murder. They charged me with what someone else was convicted of and then prosecuted me for that. So it's like, you know, somebody was charged with killing person X and found guilty, then they could somehow come and charge me with killing person X and find me guilty as well. Because that's really, and that's how absurd it is, to where they're taking case law, case precedents under the guise of common law, that any, you know, decision that comes out from a court is something that is beholden to all of us. And even the kingdoms or the Commonwealth countries or the constitutional monarchies are common law countries as well.
Right. Right, exactly. Well, I guess the question at a certain point becomes, to what extent can we rely on the court system or the federal government to give anything remotely resembling a fair trial, now that we know that the entire system is corrupt and slanted against the whistleblowers who want to bring these types of deeds to public scrutiny?
But it's not just whistleblowers, because at some point, think about it, you pay your taxes, right? Why do we only pay for the police and prosecution? How come we do not pay for a valid defense? And I'm not talking like, you know, public defender. I'm talking like a real, viable, aggressive defense, you know, system that is there as part of our taxes. So it's not just us paying for us to be captured and trapped, guilty or not. You know, we do or supposedly are supposed to have the presumption of innocence. And that is one thing that has been stricken from not only our own system, but all other systems throughout the world. Regardless of what type of a system they have, that the presumption of innocence is no more. And then it's almost as if we're somehow all, you know, questionably aligned with, unknown, undeclared terrorist or terrorist cells or terrorist groups, as if you're not part of this royal, worldwide global elite. And they are royal. I mean, you know, all these individuals and families are interconnected, and they have set up a form of global aristocracy. And it is, like I brought up even to you before, is that what is going on is they're trying to reinvigorate, to recreate, and even in a new-speak sort of way, you know, using New World Order, this new world United Kingdom, or this reinvigoration of what was commonly known and is still known today as the United Kingdom. And I was going to say, and to make all countries kingdoms, feudal systems.
Absolutely, to centralize power into the hands of the very, very few, exactly. And that's the system that's been going into place for a long time now, as we've talked about in previous interviews.
And you nailed it right on the head, though, because it's a central to where they take rights and liberties and property and benefits and more away from you, and take them as far away from you as possible so that you can't enforce them. And so that somebody else, they could even give your rights and benefits to someone else without your knowledge.
Which is exactly why I think that the way to fight against this is not to call for any type of legislation or things at the federal level, but to reinforce state sovereignty and states' rights.
I agree. But again, you have to understand that that goes into their game plan. Because almost like going to my military academy, one of the things that they do, whether it's Kings Point, West Point, Annapolis Air Force Academy, I won't even mention the Coast Guard Academy, because that's a police academy, not a federal military service academy. But they do the same thing there as well, is that they try to break you down, strip you of everything, shave your head, take away your rights to free speech, force you to walk 6 inches from the wall, not speak until spoken to, et cetera, et cetera. And then if you behave and conform and be like everyone else, as you're told, then your rights are given back to you as privileges. That can always be taken back away again. You know, like they'll give you soda privileges, or they'll give you phone privileges. And that literally is what a kingdom is, to where you don't really have rights you do to an extent, but at some point, and this is something that's actually been fought, whether it's a kingdom or a constitutional republic, for eon in time, you know, 1,000 years or more. It's what the Magna Carta was about, was taking the rights that the king felt that he held to himself and no one else. And the barons and lords and others fought to not only protect themselves, but protect their families and other families that were under their care.
That's right. The Magna Carta established, really for the first time in human civilization, certain rights that were absolutely just inherent in the people and that the king could not take away. So that was such an important document. And all of our Western jurisprudence has really been based on that. And in the last few decades, we've just seen such remarkable repeals of such of the basic tenets of jurisprudence, from habeas corpus to other things that are just horrific in their scope.
I had habeas corpus right on the tip of my tongue. That's what I was going to say. Because that's an ancient right. It's 800-900 years old or older.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So and now we're living in a society where there are no-fly lists that are about to become no-buy lists, where just for no reason whatsoever, some faceless, nameless bureaucracy can put your name on a list and you'll forever be subject to enhanced interrogation and all sorts of discrimination. And there's just no appeal from it. And this is the ultimate Orwellian society that we seem to have sleptwalked into for the last few decades.
And I'm the, you know, proverbial canary in the coal mine, that it's happening to me on an extreme level, where, you know, we even joked last time we talked that I'm living the life not of Riley, you know, so to speak. I'm living the life of Kafka.
It is. It is a Kafka-esque situation where there is just this bureaucracy which is prosecuting you, and it seems to be no way out, really. So that's...
Well, and they've charged me with being depressed. So think about that, whether it's a state agency or a federal agency, or it's a federal government, or it's a branch of military like the Coast Guard. How can anybody charge and prosecute somebody for 8 to 9 years for something like being depressed? How is that even a valid charge?
Excellent question. Excellent question, and one that I guess we're still waiting for some sort of answer to, and it will never come because there isn't one.
Right, and then, you know, because now they've changed it, it's almost like charging somebody with jaywalking and then turning it into murder, to where now they've you know, brought charges against me for quote-unquote being depressed, and they've proven somehow that I'm medically, mentally incompetent and quote-unquote mentally ill with several diseases that I was born with somehow. And it's like no DNA testing, no CAT scan, no PET scan, no x-rays, no blood testing, no blood gas, chromatography. It said no testing whatsoever, and they want to clear my name or to prove my own innocence. They want to compel me to testify against myself in a psychiatric examination outside of the hearing, outside of the system of due process, in an unrecorded proceeding before a psychiatrist that I am not allowed to bring my attorney to. And that he'll be able to report what happened in those proceedings.
Exactly. Exactly.
Via hearsay.
Exactly. I mean, the idea that they want to do that off the record and unrecorded and yet use it in the record and as part of your proceeding is just so on its face ridiculous that I think people can see what's really being attempted there.
Well, why do they need to, in their rules, and these are rules, these are not coming from law, they're creating this stuff in this common law court that they've created, and it's not a common law court, it's not a civil court, and the common law is supposed to be reserved and preserved to the people. They're not supposed to be using common law to prosecute people. It's by federal or state statute, period.
That's right. So again, what's the answer? What's the response?
Well, of course, I need help. I mean, I need intervention by the American people, by even people around the world. This isn't about me. This is about all of us, because at some point it's very clear. I mean, I have an order, and you've read it, the Commandant's Decision on Appeal, Shine 2689, to where it's very clear I've raised the issue of the Coast Guard being a branch of military and them saying that I am a civilian. And the Coast Guard Commandant, Vice Admiral Bryce O'Hara, the very same woman from the Coast Guard that came out and declared that BP and the Coast Guard were partners, has declared that she doesn't have a problem with that, and she doesn't think that the NTSB or anyone else would have a problem with that.
Speaking of which, I haven't caught it myself, but did you catch the recently aired episode of Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura about the BP spill?
Dude, you're reading my mind, man. How are you doing that?
Great minds think alike.
Yeah, right. No, because I saw it last night, and as I mentioned Bryce O'Hara, and that's what I went to right in my own mind, and maybe that's what made me think of it. But she's the one who came out and declared that the Coast Guard and BP were partners, and she's the one who has signed my Commandant's Decision on Appeal. And if she's not leaving the country, she should, because it's clear to me, and hopefully it's becoming more clear to others, that she is an agent for the Crown. She is an agent for the Queen. Even in the Coast Guard's proceedings, they accused me. It's in there somewhere about, that's my opinion. And because I have that opinion, it doesn't mean I'm crazy. And it doesn't mean that because they're forcing me, they're in these proceedings. And when I file a motion that I'm being compelled to do by them, which, you know, basically forcing somebody to testify against themselves, against their will, by forcing them to be their own counsel, they are using that against me as evidence.
Right. Well, BP is obviously an extension of Crown power, probably the most obvious extension into the so-called private economy, other than perhaps Royal Dutch Shell. And it's quite obvious what that whole situation was really about.
Right. But you've also seen where a vice admiral in the Coast Guard has somehow come up with a perception, been trained, been put in place, whatever, with the opinion that she, as a Coast Guard commandant, is a partner with BP, not a partner with the American people, not a partner with the stupid, you know, with the land mass, not a partner with of America or whatever, not a partner with the fish, the American fish, and I hate to sound stupid, but you know, with our livestock or with our natural resources, but she is declaring affinity and partnership and some affiliation with a foreign and clearly royal corporate interest.
And the worst part is, I think most of the American public have not even picked up on that.
No, and that's where, you know, I mean, look what I'm talking about, even with the Coast Guard. I talked to, I sent you a copy of the audio and the video. Ernest Hancock from Freedom Phoenix, he's got a website and he puts out emails every day in the morning and the evening. I don't know if you've seen them. I think I sent you a copy of one too.
That's right, and I'll be putting a link to the archive video and radio archives that you sent me in the interview tab for this interview itself.
Well, he's of the opinion, and I don't want to trash him or where his stance is or whatever. But from what I understood, is that it's too late, it's over, and you better get guns and butter because it's coming, and that there's nothing that we can do. And in my mind, I don't. You know, that's like, I don't think our founding fathers would have taken that, position. I don't think anybody back, even when the UK and the Commonwealth and the Crown was at its height back in the, maybe I'm fooling myself that, you know, they're at the height now. But, you know, back in the 1700s, when we declared independence and fought a Revolutionary War, and, you know, that was one of the things that actually the German Axis in World War II had targeted was all of the former and or current or present at the time Commonwealth, you know, assets of the United Kingdom, of England, of Britain in World War II. That's part of why the Axis was formed, specifically.
Sorry, can you say that again?
The Axis, I was watching, it was last night, the History Channel or whatever. But they showed, and I've read and researched some of this myself as well. The Axis powers, the Japanese emperor and Hitler and Mussolini had actually formed a bond, and one of their specific targets was the United Kingdom, England, and all of
yes,
them.
Right.
Yeah.
I see.
Because, I mean, think about how big the empire really was in that day and age.
Well, absolutely. Certainly, it was huge and on the decline at that point, but still just a force to be reckoned with.
Well, still the powerhouse, the largest empire in the world at the time.
Hmm. Absolutely. But, of course, there's also the suggestion that Hitler was a British agent, but we won't get into
right,
that discussion.
Yeah. Right, right. Well, but you know, though, too, that there's those who, and I don't, like, even Churchill. I'm not a big fan of Churchill, and Churchill was chastised by the British people after the war, basically ostracized to a large extent. One of the things that he did was he had the Enigma machine and was communicating with Germans inside Germany, spies, whether they were on quote-unquote our side or their side, or whether he was on our side or their side, is a matter, I feel, for at least open dispute, either way. Because what he did was he actually had the information on when certain cities were going to be bombed in advance, because they had one of the Enigma machines, the decoding and encryption device, and they're matched sets, the ones that the Germans made, much like much of our electronic ones today. They go out in matched sets, and they only work as matched sets. And at some point, you have to have the two that are set. And it goes to, like, you know, control so people can't tap in and more. And so it's to control the message traffic so that it's not just going out to everyone and anyone, and that it's much more focused. But which makes it more, suspicious, because they actually had to sneak out one of these devices and get it into the hands of the Brits and into Churchill's hands. But rather than evacuating these cities and saying, well, we have intel and it's come through so-and-so and make up some kind of cover and saving the lives of his fellow Brits, he allowed tens of thousands of people to die in bombings, made the decision to let them die.
And it was the same at Pearl Harbor. They knew the attack was coming and they let it happen.
Well, and that goes into, like, even in Jesse Ventura's most recent conspiracy theory program about the BP Gulf disaster, and they mentioned Katrina and everything else in there as well, and they've actually had this thread through going through a lot of their programs, and I would ask any listeners out there, to help me get into the hands of Jesse Ventura so I can tell him and explain to him about, because I think he would get it as a Navy SEAL, what the Coast Guard and Homeland Security is up to, you know, and declaring it's a branch of military and all this. But the common thread was about depopulation. And that they're really kind of keying in on this. That, and I've said that for the longest period of time, that not only Katrina and pumping out the Ninth Ward, because I don't know if you remember seeing pictures of when they were pumping out the, after Katrina, the Ninth Ward, they just basically took all this sewage, for want of a better term, this toxic waste of gasoline and kerosene and paint and all sorts of other stuff that people had in their garages or laying around or at, you know, industrial sites. And that ended up in the water when all of it got flooded, and they just pumped all of this right out into the Gulf.
Right. Or how about the toxic trailers that FEMA so lovingly gave the victims of that horrible disaster?
Right. And then even on Jesse's show, he comes out and they talk about this plan to depopulate and move the people out of this region entirely.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it is part of an agenda that we've been covering on this program for years now. And it's an unfortunate and horrific truth, which is why I think so few people are really prepared to go there and look at that information.
Well, and that's the thing, is they trust their government and they want to believe that their parents won't hurt them.
Or at the very least, even if they don't trust, they think it's all incompetence and just ineptness on the part of the government. But the idea mm-hmm. that government could be actively using its powers against the people, now that's just unthinkable.
Well, and if they're that incompetent, then they shouldn't have those powers.
Exactly. So if 9/11 was the result of massive incompetence on every single level of the system, failing to act properly on that day, then why did no heads roll after that incident?
Exactly. If it was incompetence, then, I mean, because think about what I'm being charged with. They're trying to prove that I'm incompetent.
Exactly. But
see, the point is they're supposed to go after you for an act of professional incompetence, a violation that you carried out of a law, rule, or regulation, not to go after you and charge you with being incompetent. Because being incompetent is not the act of incompetence.
And if I recall correctly, one of the people testifying against you in that case was a Coast Guard doctor who had never actually examined you.
No, never talked to me. He didn't even have a release form for the records. And guess what? It turns out that the medical records that they obtained has the wrong Social Security number. Yeah. Well, and beyond, they actually took records that they had, whether some of them were mine or not, or someone else's. But there's a page in there, and we've talked about this before, where the individual who answered it, it was a true-false question, and it was a statement saying, evil spirits possess me at times. And I, of course, I believe it, that came from my own, and or whomever answered it false, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And the Coast Guard put forth as if I or whoever answered that put forth that it was true. And they had the answer sheet in front of them. And they also had that this was the back sheet of this document, to where on the top of the document it said that only the questions that were highlighted in bold were red flags or concerns. Well, none of these had been highlighted, and they also had the answer sheet that didn't reflect what they were trying to say. And this is not the only thing. There was a bunch of them. And so they, you know, why would they have to do that? The other thing, too, is that in these Coast Guard proceedings, that if I don't give evidence against myself, testify against myself in an unrecorded proceeding outside of the system of due process, that can be held against me, that in the lack of evidence that I am forced to or compelled to give against myself, if I do not do that, that can be weighted against me as if it were true, as if the evidence would have an adverse effect upon my position. And in Jaffe v. Redmond, which is U.S. Supreme Court, this was a police officer. And, you know, I'm no different. So I'm a federal maritime officer and a naval officer. We're you know, as much a policeman to an extent, if not more so, being branch of military. We're trained with weapons and more.
Right. To be clear, and, you're not saying you're a policeman in the sense that you have jurisdiction over the civilians, but...
Well, no, we have regulatory powers exactly. As a civilian. I am trained on 33 and 46 CFRs or USC, just like the Coast Guard is, because I'm responsible that if a shipmate or the shipping company or a chief engineer or anyone else goes to dump oil in the ocean, I am obligated as a licensed federal maritime officer, American flag officer, to report upon it. I am duty bound by my position, by my oath, by my license and more, that if they're violating the law, I'm not only supposed to confront them about it and say, you're not supposed to do that, and here's why, and try to prevent it as best I can, and if not, then report it.
Right. Well, sorry to take you off track. So you're talking about the legal precedent?
Jaffe v. Redmond, but you bring up another point when you say precedent, because they're trying to say that my case is a case of first impression, a case of precedence on several grounds. But Jaffe v. Redmond was the estate of a person who had been killed by a police officer, sued the police officer, and it went back and forth all the way up to the Supreme Court, to where I believe it was Jaffe v. Redmond was the Supreme Court, because Redmond v. Jaffe and whatever, back and forth. But the final in the Supreme Court was Jaffe v. Redmond, and they ruled that because what they did was the lower court gave, or actually gave an inference, because the police officer would not give up the records, refused to, his attorney refused to, they were ordered to do so, so they refused to. The court took a negative inference against that, that there must be something in the records that would, shine a negative light upon the officer. And what's happened since then is not only the Supreme Court has ruled on this and upheld in Jaffe v. Redmond that everyone, especially police, even because the bar is set like police officers, if a police officer who has a gun is in this job where, they enforce the law, and they could actually end up killing somebody accidentally or on purpose, if they're protected, their rights of privacy and privilege are protected, so are ours. Because the bar is set very high that it's not, there's no dangerous person exception, that if you're, say, a dangerous person like a cop or somebody that, we can't afford to have a rogue or crazy cop out there, or a police officer or federal officer or FBI officer. It's the same situation for a civilian, because a civilian has less access to the system than a police officer, who can get into just about anywhere if they want to, into a court building or, and a lot of them can actually get around any kind of security measures.
Yes, exactly right.
But in Jaffe v. Redmond, the Supreme Court upheld that he had a right to privacy and privilege, and that the court should not have taken a negative inference against him not turning over the records, and that he had every right to refuse to, because the whole point was, and 50 states have legislated this since, here in the United States, all 50 states, Clinton, as the president, put out an executive order to this effect as well. The Supreme Court ruled on it and upheld it, that the purpose of it is so that police officers who are in a very stressful position, and myself included in what I do, and others, or whistleblowers, that, just like even Daniel Ellsberg, that you have the right to privacy and privilege so that this cannot be somehow used against you, and that you are afforded counseling and the protection of counseling so that you feel comfortable going there and actually, getting it off your chest, so to speak, what happened. Because, there's an adage out there that says we're only as sick as our secrets. And if you have these police officers like holding this all this stuff in, not able to go to their priest because they're afraid that might be taken and used in a court of law, even though they've done nothing wrong and they just want to talk about it, because you've seen in my own case how things have been entirely misconstrued, how things have been fabricated, how things have been corrupted, how information has been altered.
Right. And I mean, that goes back to the precept that the government lackeys will argue, if you have nothing to hide, then you have nothing to worry about. Unless, of course, it comes to government secrets, in which case they have to be protected at all costs.
Right. And this goes, I was talking to somebody earlier about this, was, the marathon is, I believe it's from the war in Marathon, and it's tied to like the 300, that movie that's out. And I'm trying to think of Lionysus. And then I'm trying to think of the other, there was the admiral or whatever who was in charge of, I think it was a Greek or Athenian Navy. It was a Greek, I guess. As far as the runner who ran 26 miles or thereabouts to deliver a message to the generals about an impending attack, and he died at the feet of the general. And that's where the whole, you know, Olympian game, I guess, for want of a better term, or honorarium, has come from and forward in time. And it's basically honoring a whistleblower, the messenger, the person who carried the message to save the day. You know, and they know and understand that the easiest way to kill the message is to kill the messenger.
Unfortunately, yes, they do know that all too well.
Right, and I've even brought up, like, in the transcripts, it's actually in there, and I brought up about the canary in the coal mine analogy, that it's as if you know, the canary starts freaking out and starts tweeting, and rather than listening to it and going, you know, the canary's having a bad day, going over there and beating the crap out of it, stepping on it and killing it, and saying, oh, cool, finally, you know, the
shut
canary's
it up.
Quiet.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. It's like, as an engineer, one of the things that we learn is you never silence an alarm. And what I mean by that is not by going over and pushing it and acknowledging the alarm and correcting it, but where what a lot of guys do is sometimes we'll get a false alarm. It's like a nuisance alarm. Like say your fuel tank on board a big ship is full, and there's high level alarms on the tank so that you don't spill on deck and it doesn't vent out through the vents. So you go up to a certain level and you shut it off. Well, if you get in high seas, if the tank is full and pressed up, it may not come out the vents, but it may trigger and set off the high level alarm. And so rather than, you know, turning it off every time, what some engineers will do, or for a period of time, you'll log it. And you can do this if you do it in a proper fashion. You're supposed to write it on the board, call the bridge, you know, make sure that it's everywhere, that everybody knows that this has been, you know, disabled, and then go ahead and disable it. But the norm is, or the standard is, that you do not disable alarms, because the alarms are there for a reason. It's a part of the loop. And what they've done and what the royals are doing and these families and, you know, corporate interests are doing is they're taking out the alarm system. They're attacking our systems of due process, grievance and arbitration, state courts, federal courts, whistleblowers, you know, grievance processes, unions, and more, to where anyone who complains becomes a target.
Right, and they're all doing this through the legal system itself and through passing laws. So it's a systematic dismantling of all the alarms.
Well, and it's not good for them. It's like you know, working on, say, a dam, a large dam, like, say, Hoover Boulder Dam in I want to say Colorado, but for the Colorado River, it holds back enormous amount of water. And it's like having an engineer there who notices a crack in the dam, and it's starting to get worse. And then it's like cutting the phone lines for him, making sure that he doesn't have any kind of other, like a cell phone or even a, you know, telegraph or any other way to communicate, even smoke signals, to send up some kind of an alarm to tell people down the road, down the waterway, that, hey, the dam is coming apart at the seams.
And then putting him in the janitor's closet and handcuffing him to a post so he can't go
anywhere. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
No, that's unfortunately true. And you say it's not good for them, but it is, of course, good for them if they want that dam to break, if they want the flooding to happen.
And if they get their people out of the way, because that's a lot of what's going on with this disaster capitalism. And it's, you know, even that was brought up in Jesse Ventura's, you know, most recent show, the one on BP. And I'm glad Jesse's going out there doing this. I hope he gets even more aggressive. And I hope he starts a whole little niche industry and or some competition in others who are doing the same thing, which, you know, happens to be the norm. Somebody gets a good idea and people like it and it becomes popular, just like, you know, reality shows.
Well, to be fair, I think Jesse Ventura is taking a lot from the alternative, what the alternative media has been doing for years on the internet, but at least he's bringing it to a much wider audience now, so my hat's off to him for doing that. But just to back up for a second, you used the term disaster capitalism, which I've never heard before, but it's a beautiful term. Did you coin that yourself, or is that from...
No, actually, Naomi Klein.
Okay.
She wrote... trying to think of what...
Did she write No Logo?
She did.
Yeah.
Hold on one sec. My phone or my connection may go out here.
Okay.
I'm trying to find her because I'm on wireless.
Hmm.
Can you still hear me?
I certainly can.
This is going to take one sec. She wrote The Shock Doctrine.
Right.
Yeah. And that in there, she exposes and comes out with what this whole, you know, game plan is. It's basically almost like the example we gave, saying that... a better example would be saying, okay, look, the World Trade Center towers, we don't like them anymore. We want to get rid of them. They've got asbestos in them. We can't demolish them because if we did, everybody and their mother would be up in arms, and it would take us 20 years to even get the rights to do it before we could even do it. And the asbestos, okay, we could go in and rehab the buildings, but that's going to cost billions of dollars to get the asbestos out. And then it's going to, you know, injure commerce and more. Or if there's somebody who just doesn't like that the United States has the quote-unquote World Trade Centers here in the United States and they want them to be somewhere else in the world, say like in a kingdom or some Asian country or, you know, because like what's the tower now in what's the one Asian country that's actually a little more progressive?
I recently visited Taipei, and they had Taipei 101, but it's not that. You're talking about Petronas Towers, or...
They have one. It's like the largest. It's like to, you know, it's the largest tower in the world now, I think.
Yeah.
And
it's been several competing for a while now. But yeah,
right.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
But it's like saying, look, we want to do away with the World Trade Center for whatever reason, just because of the asbestos, or they want to build a bigger building, they want to, do something different with the property, or there's political ends towards this on a much grander scale.
Right, exactly. So it's not to say that 9/11 occurred just because of the World Trade Center, but certainly an operation like that would take into account all sorts of things like that that can be used to generate unimaginable wealth for people. And of course, the World Trade Center handling all of those trade requests all around the world on an instantaneous basis, and all of the trading that was going on in the hours before 9/11 took place, that's come to light because of the hard drives that were recovered from the rubble of the World Trade Center. And there's just a huge, huge, huge story to be had there about the anomalous transactions. There's also the $12 billion of gold that was underneath the World Trade Center.
Right.
And there was the Enron files in World Trade Center 7. So there's all sorts of things that come together.
Lloyd's of London. There, you could go on and on about all the insurance companies.
Absolutely, yes.
Marsh McLennan. And you know, if you start looking into the whole issue of the World Trade Center and the issues of Admiralty, because the Port Authority owned those buildings.
That's right. And lucky Larry Silverstein had leased them for 99 years just a few months before it happened.
And he had a clause in there, coincidentally, that covered him for terrorist attacks.
Yep, and he tried to argue that each attack was a separate incident, so it would double his reimbursement.
And
ultimately, I don't think he lost that, but he still ended up getting $4 billion out of that.
I think he won part of it, then had to give part of it back, or
right,
they knocked it.
Right, it was an ongoing legal struggle. But in the end, I believe it was over $4 billion that he ended up getting.
It's the best investment he ever made.
Absolutely, a few million dollars down. Rest of it was financed, and he ended up getting $4 billion.
Right, if you don't mind being involved in killing a bunch of people.
That's pretty much it. And as shocking and difficult as it is for most people out there like you and me to believe that anyone would do that, it does happen, and we have to be aware of that.
But you don't have to look far, because if you look to normal, average people, you have the children of their parents going in and having them declared incompetent, oftentimes when they're not necessarily incompetent, to take over their property, take away their homes, take away their estate, take away their trust, take away any money that they have in the bank, and have them committed and put away.
Right. We're at the most trivial example. I mean, people will inherently understand when someone kills a taxi driver or something for $80 in cash, but somehow just have this mental block about mass murder taking place for billions, if not trillions of dollars, and they just cannot get their heads around that.
Right. The people that are entrusted with this much power wouldn't do that.
Exactly. They wear a suit, and they talk nice, and they're well-educated, so they couldn't possibly be killers.
Well, what's the old adage about, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely?
Indeed. Well, I think it's even more subtle than that, because I think there's a psychopathic element that is actually attracted to positions of power. And unfortunately, we live in a system where those types of people can get to the top simply because they are willing to do whatever it takes to get there.
Yes. And because we're not ever vigilant in making sure that those people don't get there.
Exactly. And that's the missing element. I mean, the system can be brought under control if there is an educated and informed public watching like hawks over the system. But unfortunately, we've been trained to submit to government and submit to the propaganda that says to lay down and everything's okay and the system will take care of you. And of course, that's a blatant outright lie, but people have been lulled into a false sense of security.
Well, because we are the government. So how can you be submissive to yourself?
Exactly. Like, exactly.
You know, right. And at some point, you know, especially in our... And I would say in yours as well, you know, as far as Canada or being a Commonwealth country or constitutional monarchy, it's still, in my mind, because this is, it's changed dramatically, and a constitutional monarchy today is not what one was 100, 200, 500 years ago. It is still much more so, or is supposed to be much more so, of by and for the people.
Right. Well, we have the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is, I guess, roughly equivalent to the Bill of Rights and Constitution of the United States, except for the fact that, as we saw in the Toronto G20 earlier this year, it can be completely just, they can say it doesn't exist around this certain area because this is an important area for this point in time. And they can say it, and it's not true, and it comes out later that that was all legal fiction and a fraud, but no one will get punished for it. And for that time being, they were able to completely, utterly suspend the Charter of Rights and Freedoms for people around the G20 area. And it's disgusting, absolutely horrific, and Canadians have lied down and accepted that. So,
well, and that terrible. Is, I hate the term when people say, you know, we get the government we deserve, because I don't believe that. And I actually, there was a movie, it was in Mel Gibson, and he was, his daughter had gotten somehow involved in a nuclear weapons manufacturing plant, and she was kind of blowing the whistle, and she ended up dying or being killed, and he's a police officer. And he investigated, you know, her death, and it got into this whole, you know, sinister level of macabre that was going on behind the scenes, where you've got people in our own country who are not necessarily Americans, who are not necessarily working for America, but to a large extent, for whatever reason, are being protected by our government.
Exactly. So so again, the question always comes back to, what do the people do to take their government back?
Well, and that's where we are the ultimate oversight. We are the power. And if people would, you know, whether doing it locally first and foremost, and then pushing, because really a congressman and or a senator in our states should not have that much power. You know, they
exactly right.
I mean, they should, to an extent, for investigations, to find out, like, if there's state corruption going on and more. But at some point, and it's amazing how difficult it is, and I'm telling you from personal experience, in all of this, even though I was congressionally appointed by several congresspersons' offices and got a congressional nomination and appointment to the academy and graduated from the academy, and I'm minimally, and I would not say this myself, a veteran, I believe and assert that I am and continue to be a naval officer, because that's been stripped from me unlawfully and improperly and in retaliation for, you know, whistleblowing. I cannot get before a congressman or a senator and tell them what's going on and ask for intervention. I've not, ever since this whole process started, if not a few years before, as I was writing letters to the Coast Guard and others about what was going on, of course, stuff that they've used against me.
Exactly. You know, this, yeah. Well, they've taken your private letters to congressmen and others and used them against you in the proceedings. Just unbelievable.
Well, but even beyond that, letters that I wrote to, like, Secretary of Transportation, which I have a statutory right to do, not just constitutional, free speech and more, but a statutory right in the Merchant Marine Act of 1936 that gives us a specific right to contact the Secretary of Transportation, and I, you know, Norm Mineta, of course, at the time. And I did so, and they took a section of that letter out of context where I had brought up about Timothy McVeigh and how we have domestic crime and or terrorism going on in our own country, and that we cannot ignore it, and that we have to pay close attention to racketeering or corruption going on, whether it's domestic or international, if it's occurring in our country, and not just simply pass it on and say, well, yeah, you know, that's been going on for a long time, don't worry about it, because it opens up conduits for international crime and or terrorists. My point was that, look, you know, even on the issue of, and whether it was because Timothy McVeigh and that whole issue is like a red flag or some kind of hot button, in Oklahoma City and the bombing is some kind of hot button, it was taken entirely out of context of what I was saying and outlined in the letter, and to where they used it to try to connect me to Timothy McVeigh.
Absolutely, a ridiculous and untenable position that could only work in such a thing as kangaroo court, basically. I mean, that's what you're in.
Well, in my name for the Coast Guard, and anyone in the Coast Guard that's doing their service and following the law and Constitution and not involved, you know, specifically in these matters, like Admiral Loy, and I'm talking about people who are involved and who have a direct, you know, they're criminals in my mind, they're war criminals. Admiral Allen, Admiral Loy, Admiral Collins, Admiral Bryce O'Hare, there's a bunch of others, you know, Captain French, Lieutenant Commander Christopher Tribolet, Lieutenant Commander Walter J. Brzezinski, ALJ McKenna, Yancey, and others who are knowingly, willingly participating in this. But to all those others in the Coast Guard that aren't involved and that are just, when I say doing their job, I don't mean in the mindset of being a good German and turning a blind eye to atrocities and poor, if not even criminal behavior going on in their agency, somebody needs to pay close attention to and stop and prevent what the Coast Guard is doing. And not just to me, but in this drive to create, I mean, think about it. We've talked about this as well, where the Coast Guard was the icebreaking service. The Revenue Cutter Marine, which was Treasury Department. It's like IRS on the water, or customs, basically. The Life Saving Service, the Lighthouse Service, and other services. How do you get a special branch of military from all that can carry on and adjudicate and administer, police, regulate, and enforce, and even make civilian laws somehow?
Well, the obvious answer is that you can't get a special branch of the military from that. So the question is, how did it become that? And perhaps we should look a bit at the history. So tell people once again, who founded the Revenue Cutters?
Well, Alexander Hamilton formed the Revenue Cutter in 1790. And in 1791, they passed the Shipping Articles Act of 1791. And that goes to not only officers in the Merchant Marine, and you have to understand that the first fleet was the United States Merchant Marine. It was not the Coast Guard or the Revenue Cutter Marine. And the Revenue Cutter Marine was not the Coast Guard. Two different agencies entirely. But the Coast Guard is trying to, you know, trace its roots back to 1790 and Hamilton, and is basically, you know, acting as an agent, as Hamilton had intended, for foreign and royal interests. From everything I've seen of Hamilton, I don't, you know, even in the Federalist Papers and more, I believe that, you know, some of the people that I've been involved with, intentionally or by affiliation or by holding hands, but have come across and who I've sought help from, not knowing who these people were, people like Marcy Winograd. She's running for office. She was running against Jane Harman for her seat in Congress. And Jane Harman is, you know, she's old blood, you know, blue blood money, corporate money, Harman Kardon Electronics. She's the richest person in Congress or the Senate, I believe. Marcy Winograd was running against her, And Marcy Winograd's father, and I found this out from conversations and talking to them and just listening very carefully, that her father was a member of the World Federalist Society. And I believe that's what Hamilton was, not a member of a federal society from a limited republic, but a member of the Federalist Society, a World Federalist Society that believed in world government.
Exactly. Well, what's the logical extension of the principles of federalism? If it's better to centralize power in, you know, Washington, why isn't it better to centralize world power in London or wherever?
Right. Well, and then you say London, and that's where I look to, and not only Hamilton, but the revenue cutter Marine was not federal. It was not national. It was actually broken up by Hamilton's peers because they ostracized him for doing this. Actually it was Hamilton that was shot by Burr, right? Aaron Burr.
That may be the case. I don't know.
Aaron Burr was actually a member of the Democratic Republican. It was Tammany Hall, and he was a member of the Democratic Republican Party. The Democrats and the Republicans were one party in the same. They were not separate. They saw the common enemy, which was England, the crown. Any crown is an enemy to a republic, because the crown wants, not, I wouldn't say life, liberty, property, you know, basically any and all rights, privileges, and they want privileges, not entitlements, because an entitlement, like Bush was even arguing against, is your right under the law. It's a statutory right. An entitlement is something that is given to you by the people, by your predecessors or your peers or yourself, for yourself. It's not granted by some royal power. It's not a privilege or benefit that is granted and bestowed that could be taken away at the drop of a hat.
Right. Sorry, just to backtrack and back you up. Yes, it was Vice President Burr that shot Hamilton in a duel on July 11th, 1804. Anyway.
Right. And you have to look into like all that as well and tie it into like not only what Tammany Hall was in the Democratic Republican Party. After Adams, the next four presidents who each served two terms were all members of the Democratic Republican Party. And what they've done is, you know, not only the adage of keep your enemies close or keep your friends close and your enemies closer, but the adage of divide and conquer.
Exactly. And that's exactly why we have the modern day Democrat Republican two-headed hydra that's two wings of the same bird of prey.
Exactly. And they're basically two sides of the same goalpost that if you want to score, you've got to kick in between the left upright or the right upright to be able to lead a happy and fruitful life.
I can still remember the days back in 2006 when the Republicans lost the House in the midterm elections, and I at the time truly thought, oh well, the Bush administration will start to see the types of trials that need to go on to make sure that this never happens again, and there will be a thorough repudiation of the Bush government. Ha 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 ha. The joke was on me, but I woke up quickly enough after that.
Yeah, but that didn't happen to Reagan.
Yeah, exactly. And now, of course, exactly, from the perspective of someone who now realizes the left-right paradigm and
right.
What it's about, it's easy to see that it's never, ever been about actually bringing criminals to justice. It's about furthering the ability of criminals to operate.
Well, these are crime families. It's the same thing that took down Rome and the Roman Republic. It was these crime families who worked together with each other, who didn't have anyone in there. Common folk who said, you can't do that. What are you guys thinking? You guys are high. That's stupid. That's immoral. That's corrupt. And then they might go and stop and think about it and go, yeah, you're right. Except these people, like you pointed out, are sociopaths. They don't. They have no moral compass. They don't. Even if they had a little Geppetto or sitting on their shoulder, they would not feel guilty. They don't have a conscience. They feel that they have a divine right to beg, borrow, and steal and strip the fruits of your labor off your back from you, because they are your betters.
Unfortunately, that is the ideology which undergirds the system, and it's important to keep in mind that tyranny at its highest level functioning really is nothing other than rampant criminality in government, and unless people understand criminality for what it is, unfortunately it will serve to perpetuate itself and to function as any other criminal conspiracy would. But of course, even the Cosa Nostra was a conspiracy theory according to Hoover and the FBI until it was, well, basically, just they couldn't deny it anymore. So we have to break that paradigm that people have, that it's all a conspiracy theory that there are criminals in government.
Well, these guys, but they're not just in government, they're holding hands. Like, here's a perfect example, and forget about the familiar relations or not. Admiral Loy, when he was the Coast Guard Commandant, set up the system to require or create the Transportation Worker Identification Card, a biometric ID card required of all transportation workers. And this was done when, you know, Homeland Security was still in the Transportation Department somehow. After setting up the regulations or requirements in the government for who he was really working for, Lockheed Martin, as a military federal contractor, he leaves federal service as an admiral, retires with 30, 40 years, a really great pension, all kinds of money and property from being an admiral for, you know, 10, 15 years or more, and, you know, working up the ranks and having, you know, consistent employment. And he goes to work for Lockheed Martin, the very company that he set up the whole racket for, just like Chertoff did with the body scanners.
You're exactly right to point that out, and I must admit it is sloppy in my speech and the speech of others when we only refer to the government as the center of power. Obviously, the corporations are intimately involved, and they've become so intermingled at the top that I think to differentiate the two is the wrong way of looking at it. I mean, governments are corporations are governments.
That's fascism.
Exactly right.
It's corporatism.
That's exactly the other term for, that's what Mussolini said fascism should rightly be called, is corporatism.
And that's not our system. And that's what I believe that, you know, to an extent, even the royal families in England fought against in World War I and II.
Royal families were more on Hitler's side than on the British people, that's for sure.
Because they're making a killing. It's just like what Martin Bormann did in moving the capital and even genetic capital, the family line, and property rights and intellectual property and real property out of Germany for over 750 families during and leading up to the end of World War II. It's the same thing going on here in the United States right now. And now what Bush has set up is this worldwide global United Kingdom of the Rainbow Coalition of Fascists. Doesn't matter what race or ethnicity or religion you aspire to claim. Now, as long as you're royal and you can trace your lines and you declare and you believe in or you wish to serve the various royal families, then you're part of the game. If not, you're out there in your cannon fodder.
That's it, unfortunately. Rainbow Coalition of Fascists is a good way of referring to it, unfortunately.
Well, and they are, because it doesn't matter if you're red, white, and blue, or brown, or yellow, or anything else. White, black, doesn't matter. As long, like guys like Alberto Gonzalez, he's no better. Cheney, same. Bush, same. Condoleezza Rice, same.
John Yoo, same.
John Yoo, same. And you go down this whole long laundry list of these people like Ken Starr, trying to think of the guy from, Ted Olson, on and on. You know, these are like Ted Olson. A lot of these people are in fact members of the Federalist Society.
Exactly right, and people should reacquaint themselves with what the debate was really about by going back to the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers, because I think there's just so valuable debates going on there that are really central to what's even still happening today.
Well, why do you think they're fighting to try to get the Federal Reserve in a bunch of other countries? Why do you think they've set up federal systems? I believe to an extent, and maybe you could correct me if I'm wrong, Canada to an extent has a federal system.
Well, theoretically, all the powers that are not vested in the federal government do default to the provinces, but it's very, very much a system that's controlled centrally in Ottawa, unfortunately.
Which is much like ours, with just different names. Like, even the what are the two houses of parliament in Canada and England?
There's the House of Parliament and the Senate.
Because there's the House of Lords in England.
In England, yeah. But in Canada, we have a Senate.
And the Lords is like the upper house, right?
Right.
And then the House of Commons is the Congress. Because if you really look at those two houses, it's exactly what we have here in Congress and the Senate. You have the House of Lords, mm-hmm. which is all the and what the Senate is and how it functions. And then the Congress, which is like a lower House of Lords now. You know, the House of Commons, even in England, is not so common.
Right. Well, no, obviously. I mean, you have to be a millionaire to be a congressman or to be a member of parliament in the UK or Canada. I mean, it's all well-connected people.
Right. But I believe even back when, and these people were connected, but not to the level or degree or length of time and family lineage that they are today.
Mm-hmm. That's
that
true.
Even in England's system, in Canada's, that what they've done is they've entrenched these positions for decades, if not generations and hundreds of years, to where if you're part of one of these families, you could almost survive just off of your knowledge of rubbing elbows with all these people.
Unfortunately true, but I assume that's really pertained to every period of human history. We just delude ourselves into thinking it doesn't apply to us anymore.
Well, but I think it's become more extreme in our own. That with all the developments, whether it be in technology, just the lineages have been, you know, because I think there was a break to an extent when the United States was formed, not just the colonies, but when we finally declared independence, that we didn't have as such an aristocracy or system of blue bloods that did. I mean, even if you compare California and the other, you know, even in the Midwest, and out in the West, to back East and New York and Boston, there was a real moneyed elite that arose even back in the 1800s.
That's right. And I think that's an important thing for American listeners to keep in mind. And it's difficult, I think, for American listeners to judge the British political situation without really understanding the deep-seated class divisions that are still there in Britain and are just so important to that society. If you're a member of the House of Lords or if you're, you know, part of the gentry, you're still looked on as being somehow above the rest of the people. And that's deeply ingrained into British society.
Well, that goes to my own situation at some point, is that somebody with connections or money would not be sitting in the position I am. And that's sad, because at some point it says that there is no justice for the poor.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, the American society is founded on just money, and it doesn't matter if you're new rich or old rich, but the British society is more on your family ties. But it ultimately comes to the same point, right?
Yeah, because at some point, you can buy older familial ties connections mm-hmm. with the money.
Like the Bushes married in with to Prescott Bush married into
Davis Walker family.
Right. That's what I was looking for. And
and you look at that family, the Davis Walkers, and you know who turned over California to Arnold Schwarzenegger, an Austrian prince, the son of an SS officer. You know, you didn't become an SS officer because you didn't have lineage and you couldn't be trusted and you didn't have some kind of ideology. These people were all strongly vetted.
Right. Like Prince Bernard, who became the founder of Bilderberg and the founder of the World Wildlife Fund.
Right. And they were also, you know, deeply involved in the creation of the EU.
Yep. Absolutely. From their founding documents, you can go and... In fact, WikiLeaks had them available. I don't know if they do anymore, but... 1955 yeah. meeting, they were talking about the integration that needed to happen in the creation of the European Monetary Zone. So,
well, back to speaking about whistleblowers, you know, like Assange. I have the problem I have with Assange is he's not American. You know, if this were an American, well, no, and I'm not. I know that may sound funny, but I could see how a lot of people would see this as an assault upon America. But at some point, ignore that and say that, you know, at some point, because they're saying that this could hurt America and whatever, they shouldn't be communicating on state funded communications a lot of this stuff that they are. Period. You know, about like getting into, you know, who's who and who's married to what and what proclivities they have, mm-hmm. or, you know.
But I mean, that's what diplomacy has always been about. I mean, everyone knows that. It's just not spoken about in public, right?
But then release it.
Yeah.
Fine.
Well, exactly. Because, but if the government has nothing to hide, they shouldn't be worried,
right? Exactly. Almost like what they say to us.
Right.
Well, if the government has nothing to hide, then why not, you know, why do you care? See, I think if they're going to if they're going to chip anybody, if they're going to force RFIDs on anyone, it should be the people requiring that politicians, anybody above a certain pay grade, anybody in a high sensitive job, the president or anyone else be chipped. Don't start with the people. I'm not advocating to chip anybody.
Right, right. No, I know what you're saying though. Absolutely, well, they should be the first in line. And an interesting story came out a couple of years ago on 60 Minutes when it was revealed that Rahm Emanuel had some sort of system that tracked Obama and his family wherever they went. Like he actually could track them via the whatever his cell phone or whatever he carried on him. And that was a bit of an interesting detail that came out.
Yeah, that's nice. Because then what if somebody else could, you know, capture that? Or...
Right, exactly. That is a huge issue. And then there's also, why is Rahm Emanuel, you know, the one who's, I don't know. Interesting to find out about those kinds of things.
I'm not a big fan of Rahm Emanuel. I mean, you know, both of them, in my mind, and this is one thing that was actually mentioned on Jesse Ventura's show, the most recent one. Did you see it?
I did not. I'd like to hear about it.
Well, in there they talk about Alfred Weber. I think he's from Canada. He's a naturalist and environmentalist lawyer. But he said that... Barack Obama is a CIA asset.
Yeah, I've heard that, and there's certainly some very shady aspects to his background that have never been adequately explored, we'll say, by the establishment media. I wonder why.
Well, in my mind, there's just too many questions or not necessarily parole evidence, but just strange facts that when they all come together, any kind of intel officer would look at it and say, there's something going on here that ain't right.
Right.
Well, because things like, you know, his mom is named Ann Dunham. She's English-German, just like Clinton, who, you know, and even if you go back to Clinton, you know, people don't pay attention to why is Clinton, Hillary Clinton, in New York as a senator.
Good question. Why is that?
Well, one of the first mayors of New York was named... I think it was George Clinton. So there's familial lines that stretch back. Like, I don't know if you've ever looked at Christopher Reeves.
I have watched him on Superman, if that's what you mean.
Of course. But if you look into his background, you can find it on Wikipedia and look into his family came over on the Mayflower. He can trace his roots that far back. And so you've got people that have been over here that long who feel that, you know, some have not lost their affinity or loyalty to the crown for whatever reason. I'm not saying Christopher Reeves is like that or anyone else. But there are those who have been here and have a very extended, broad family all over the United States, if not all over the world, who do not love the Republic, who do not believe that the American people or any people around the world have the capacity to rule themselves. That a republic, which is of, by, and for the people, is an abomination.
Right. And Clinton was a Rhodes Scholar.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's what I was going to go to earlier, was that Ronald Reagan was knighted by the Queen. And this goes to Jake Gyllenhaal and Maggie Gyllenhaal and Stephen Gyllenhaal, their father. Stephen Gyllenhaal was ennobled, not knighted, but ennobled by the Swedish... Queen Beatrix, she's Swedish?
No, right? I'm Dutch.
Oh, she's Dutch, right, yeah. But Gyllenhaal was ennobled by the Swedish royal family, which makes his children, Maggie and Jake, part of the nobility, Swedish nobility. And you have to say, and you go back to the Titles of Nobility Act that was passed here in the United States in 1806, that would have stripped any and all citizenship, which rights to property and more, start a business, you know, et cetera, to an extent, here in the United States. You wouldn't be able to vote and more. And even back then, it was probably even more restrictive than it is today if you weren't a citizen. To where if you had any ties to foreign and especially royal interests, royal government, under the Titles of Nobility Act that was passed in 1806, and that the Brits came into the United States in 1812 and burned the White House in response to, and burned the records of the Titles of Nobility Act and tried to make it moot. It was supposed to be our 13th Amendment. And instead, and you can go read up about it, it's part of our history, and instead of royal members of the royal families losing citizenship here in the country and losing any rights that they would have as a citizen if they were found to have ties, we have presidents like Ronald Reagan, knighted by the Queen. People like Greenspan, knighted by the Queen. And Greenspan and Reagan, one of the things that he said when he came in and he brought in Greenspan, or Greenspan brought in him, was that he wanted to devalue the dollar. Why would anybody do that? Why would anybody do that to their own people?
Well, to make their exports more competitive.
Wow, that's...
American exports. It's becoming something of an oxymoron, unfortunately.
Well, no, because it's not even make them more competitive or not. If you say, I want to make your dollar that's worth 100 pennies today worth 80 pennies tomorrow, it's an unlawful tax. It's an unlawful transfer of wealth from a certain class of people to another class.
But there are positives. We shouldn't be all negative. Ron Paul just became the chairman of the House Subcommittee on Monetary Policy. So the man who wants to abolish the Fed is now overlooking the Fed. That is a great development.
Yes, and I saw that. But, you know, and also in, I think it was Sweden, and Ireland's looking to do this as well, that they just depreciate their currency to the point where it wipes out their debt.
Well, I don't know how Ireland could do that when they're on the euro, but certainly the euro is going down the toilet, and it's just a question of how long it can last. But it's pretty much falling apart as we speak.
Right. Well, and that's where, and because think about what they're trying to do here in the United States. They're trying to merge Canada, the United States, and Mexico together. And you know what? I'm on the fence on this, because I could see how I would rather have, you know, the three countries independent in their own right, keep them as separate and distinct nation states. But I do think that we should be working together. You know, if they say they really wanted to merge us and create this union, you know, they should be thinking with their heads instead of their wallets. Because at some point, had they made the systems in Canada, Mexico, and the United States more identical, and I'm talking like transportation systems, rail, Interrail, maglev, even, you know, transportation like cargo and container ships and more, to where it was truly an integral system, to where it got to the point where it just made sense. It's like, look, we're so much alike, and that, you know, we have the same ideals, and that, you know, for the common protection, that we form some type of more perfect union. I think that there's a problem with that, because the United States would, of course, lose its unique nature as a, you know, constitutional republic, rather than Canada, unless Canada stepped forward and declared complete independence from the crown and said, look, we want to form a constitutional republic ourselves, and Mexico the same, and that at some point, you know, I don't know. If you look at the United States itself, that's how it's evolved over time, and I guess my point would be, rather than having them force it upon us, it would be better for us to elect to do it and do it under a system of by and for the people, rather than some royal system or whatever, some system that's been set up for the elites.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. In an ideal world, we could be looking at ways of working across borders, which are just imaginary lines on paper. But unfortunately, we don't live in a system that is for the benefit of the people. It's not by for the people anymore. It's by and for the elite who own the system, unfortunately. But I agree. I mean, I'm no fan of nationalism per se. It's just that I think that national boundaries are important because the centralization of power is what we're fighting against. But I'd love to see the devolution of power down to the city-state level and then using the modern technologies to connect the world, basically, to the individual city-states. But that's an ideal that is still a long way off.
But that's what made, and that was the model, was the city-states of Italy. And that's what made Italy so powerful, was the city-state model.
Or before that, Greece, yeah.
Right, and to the point where here in the United States, if not around the world, cities have become so populous that they could be their own state.
Absolutely, and it's my contention that we live in a technologically advanced enough society that it would be possible to have an international city, if you know what I'm saying. I mean, it can be connected in all the ways that a federal government is. We don't need that centralization in a far-off distant place where we send elected representatives to supposedly represent us when we know that's not taking place.
Well, and even as to war, it's not the American people that stood out there and beat the war drums. There was actually tens of millions of people in the streets trying to prevent the war in Iraq, around the world.
More than tens of thousands.
No, tens of millions.
Oh, sorry.
No, there's tens of millions of people around the world. Yeah, millions upon millions here in the United States alone. Mm-hmm. And look where we find ourselves. So this is all being, all of our problems are being constructed. Because think about it. If the royals were in such a position that they really were better to rule, then how come we've not seen that throughout history, ever? It's only when the people, when it's of, by, and for the people, that we have any semblance of order, any semblance of sane progress, any semblance of constructing commerce, trade, transportation in between and amongst various civilizations and various people.
Well, that's exactly why America was the industrial engine of the world when it was still a relatively free society.
Who? I'm sorry?
America.
Oh, right.
And now that it's becoming a Gestapo gulag of the Orwellian 1984 variety, it's becoming less and less relevant on the world stage. I mean, still the main player, but not for long.
Yeah, but you have to understand, what am I fighting? One of the issues I am and have been fighting is that our merchant marine is under attack. And not only by foreign powers, but our own government, to where the Coast Guard has done more to damage and destroy our United States merchant marine. My own case is a prime example, one of many, to where 97% of all cargo, international cargo, coming into and leaving the United States is going on foreign flag vessels. That's not a good position for America to be in, whether for civil defense or national security. We should be carrying at least the largest share, 51% or more, of cargo coming into the United States and leaving the United States on American flag ships.
Absolutely right. It's just another way in which all of the money and wealth and of America is being offshored into these multinational corporations that are beholden to no country.
Well, and that's where, think about what the lost city or the lost state of Atlantis really is. It is this, and why do you think they call it the lost continent? It is that continent that resides underneath the water around the world. It's that area that comes under admiralty jurisdiction, that comes under international jurisdiction, that is this gray zone, for want of a better term, where no laws apply and all laws apply. And that the laws that apply are international, agreed upon by the nation states, United Nations and more, and where people have a very hard time trying to find representation, let alone protect and defend themselves.
Right, good point.
And that's, that's what they're using admiralty. Like, even the Coast Guard is admiralty prerogative. It's an admiralty player. It has ships. It's called the Coast Guard. It's a maritime actor as they call it, as a legal term of art. And what they're doing is they're trying to subvert and corrupt and destroy our systems of self-protection. Like, in the event of Katrina, if we have our own ships plying our own waterways, I mean, if you go to China and you look at the number of boats that are in the water, it's amazing. And then you come to a port here in the United States and it's like, okay, there goes a boat. That's cool. No, serious. It's that. The difference, you go to a port in China and they've got ships, small, medium, large, all going back. I mean, it's a, they use their waterways and we don't.
Hmm. A dying waterway is a sign of a dying society?
Well, and because we're a maritime nation. And so we should have more trade going up and down our own coast here in California than going on our highways.
Good point.
Because you can carry a lot, you know, even with rail and everything else, and rail's great. But even our rail system, which is tied to our shipping system, you know, we should have a maglev train system on the East Corridor and the West Corridor and the North and South Corridors, minimally. That would tie America and Canada and Mexico much more together in a positive, constructive manner. Because you got to remember, these guys are crooks. They're liars, cheats, and thieves. They want to create what's going to happen in the next generation so that they have the in on it. They have the skinny so that they know where to buy and put the land for, you know, high-priced McDonald's, you know, or put a McDonald's where they can own and control the land before the you know, because this is something that was going in with the NAFTA superhighway. You had people coming in and trying to buy up wide swaths of land to where this new quote-unquote NAFTA superhighway is supposed to go. And that was before it was even known or commonly known that they were attempting to put this thing in.
Right. And I believe Prime Minister Stephen Harper of Canada referred to it as highways to the moon or something in a dismissive speech that he made after a Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America meeting, which was, of course, held behind closed doors in Montebello, Quebec back in 2007. So it is, yes, definitely part of an integrated agenda, and it's not on the side of the people. It's for, by and of, and for the corporations, as came out in documents that were released from that meeting that the Corbett Report managed to obtain through a listener who had a Freedom of Information request.
Well, and you start to look at, and you know, you really have to dig deep on these names and associations and stuff, but it's like having, you know, somebody with the last name Ford and saying, well, that they're not related to the Ford family. And somehow assuming that, where you have somebody like Jack Welch, right, who was head of GE, General Electric, mm-hmm. and then you have Welch's Grape.
Well, they're not related.
Say again?
Well, they're not related.
Well, and no, but if you start to look deeper into all this, you start to find like Campbell, as in the soup, Brown, you've got the woman named Campbell Brown on TV, on CNN, and a lot of the Anderson Cooper, who's a, you know, a son of Gloria Vanderbilt, you know, how do you think he got his job as an anchorman doing what he's doing?
Right, yeah, exactly. Well, and he interned with the CIA as well.
Well, but he's also a trust fund kid who's self-funded by his own family, if not, you know, more money with the CIA and whatever, who gets to go over to Iraq because he's so well off, he can not only afford the plane ticket, but he can afford a little, you know, crew to do some embedded, you know, journalism in the war, and then all of a sudden he comes back as a correspondent, and now he's an anchorman, and boom, you know, the rest is history.
Well, in a plutocracy, anyone with enough money can buy their way into positions that matter.
Right, and you could look to not only Kennedy to some extent. I know a lot of people love Kennedy, but if you look at his, and I believe the reason they love him is that he basically, he pissed off his father. He walked away from the Blue Bloods. He felt the affinity more for the American people than for the old bloodlines. You know, his father, Joe, was smuggling Dwar's whiskey in from Canada.
Absolutely,
backed by the,
yeah.
Backed by the Crown, warehousing it in the middle of Prohibition.
Yeah.
He was also very closely tied to Roosevelt. He found Roosevelt when Roosevelt was an undersecretary in the Navy. Roosevelt helped him, and he helped Roosevelt. But, you know, Roosevelt named Kennedy as the ambassador to England, as the first head of the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
And you start looking at all this stuff and what's gone on in the SEC now, and this is something I'm not sure if I've discussed with you, about Congressman Christopher Cox. Cox is another one of these names, like Cox Communications, Cox Cable. Cox is another one of these large corporate family names. And it's not, you just don't find them like in communication. You start looking around and you start seeing that when you travel, you really start to see this. When you get into engineering and you look at the names and the families who are making the stuff, it's like seeing Ford everywhere, you know, and you start to realize, look, it's this very small, tight-knit group of maybe 200 families here in the United States. There may be some other names that are thrown in there, but they're just, you know, offshoots of the same, you know, root families who are calling the shots here in the United States.
Right. And I'll bring it up once again, just a few months ago, just for a grade school project, some school student in the United States did a graphical representation of how the all the presidents have been connected to royal families in England. And did better work on that than the mainstream media has ever done, or will ever do, I suppose.
Or will ever do, right. Because, J.P. Morgan came to the United States, helped incite the Civil War, funded both sides of the Civil War, profited from both sides of the Civil War, took down American financial houses at the time, converted them back to crown possessions, was backed by the crown through his father, who was an English banker. And you start to go, oh. And then you go, oh, well, guess what else he started? Not only did his son sign and was signatory to the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, but his father, J.P. Morgan Sr., helped fund and start General Electric, which is the largest weapons manufacturer in the world, that owns and controls NBC, that had a real big problem with the free speech rights of David Letterman and the suits.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and unfortunately, that's at every level of the media empire is controlled by the same corporate families that control every other aspect of the economy.
Right, Disney, yep. You know, ABC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Westinghouse, you know, and CBS.
Rupert Murdoch and Fox.
Well, and see, that's an important point I brought up to somebody today, is that just like I've given the example, like with Kennedy smuggling Dolores whiskey into the United States, backed by the crown, basically setting up a treasure chest for himself as a royal pirate, for want of a better word, an administrative royal pirate, Rupert Murdoch is the same thing, if not worse. Rupert Murdoch established his media empire as backed by the crown in Australia, a member of the Commonwealth, who swears allegiance to the crown and the royal families and of the UK, to where not only was he afforded the knowledge of the industry, which translates fairly well over here in the United States as far as technology and more, but he, you know, by building his massive empire in Australia backed by the crown, comes to the United States with a ton of money, flush with technology and technical expertise and experience in the industry, and a lot of money to create Fox News and come in and dominate the American media industry.
Right. And I'm, as listeners will know, I'm suspicious of Julian Assange on many levels, but I like how he opened his recent editorial right before he submitted himself to arrest. In 1985, a young Rupert Murdoch, then owner and editor of Adelaide's The News, wrote, "In the race between secrecy and truth, it seems inevitable that truth will always win," end quote. Ha 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 ha.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Ha 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 was part of the quote.
Well, I added that for effect, but I think, you know, it was intended to generate that response.
I'm sure it was dancing around in his mind.
Yeah. I think we can only look at the fruits of his labor to see where he really stands on that that divide.
But I mean, if you think of what England does, think of the scandals in the 50s and 60s in England itself, the sex scandals with the parliament and prime ministers and others, and they've made movies about this and everything. And also, I think even Clockwork Orange was a political satire about a lot of the, you know, stuff that was going on in England a decade or so before Clockwork Orange was actually written and or, you know, put out. I think it came out actually probably closer to 20 years after. But they used this theater, you know, All the World is a Stage, and what even Assange is doing, so that people don't, because some of this stuff, a lot of the stuff actually that he's putting out, is almost like soap opera.
Ping pong, that's exactly it. Sorry, I just used a Japaneseism. I should say bingo. But yeah, that's exactly it.
And to where it's almost as if it were, you know, because even now they're going after him about this sex scandal and whatever. And he's dancing from country to country. And I guess, you know, he's under arrest now, right?
Yeah, they have finally arrested him. But, yep, and apparently they're going to bring charges. America is going to bring charges. Apparently he violated the Espionage Act as an Australian citizen who's publishing information that he got from Americans. I don't know how, but they're going to attempt to set the precedent, which is a horrific precedent. But
right, because how can you violate the Espionage Act if you're not an American?
And not in America, and not, yeah, exactly.
Right, it's like, because that law was created for Americans.
Exactly. And I mean, I could understand it if he was in the jurisdiction, but anyway.
But even then, at some point, he would have to be tried as a spy.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and then that should still fall under the federal courts, and because there's all ways to protect whatever kind of, you know, information he put out. But to some extent, I have a real big problem, because not only like what happened with Mrs. Covert in Reed versus Covert from 1957, where a American service member's wife was charged with his murder and prosecuted within a military tribunal in England under the American system. She was, her husband was serving in England. She was there, but it was the Americans in our own system that tried her in a military tribunal and drove her mad. And it was the system, or lack thereof, because these are kangaroo courts. The executive branch, and this is in that case of Reed versus Covert, the executive branch is not supposed to be carrying on any courts or tribunals. It wasn't created to that effect.
And yet it is, yeah. No, exactly.
Well, to where they're trying to do it like broadly to even strip the judiciary of its rights. And that goes to like what we talked about earlier in, not Posse Comitatus, but the writ of habeas corpus, the great writ, to where that's a judicial matter. That's a judicial issue. And for the executive branch to somehow strip the judiciary of that great writ that's been enforced, if not reinforced, for decades, if not hundreds, clearly almost 1,000 years, as an inalienable right, as a right, it doesn't matter who you are, you can afford yourself of the great writ.
Indeed. Well, Lieutenant Shine, we are coming towards the end of our time here. I have a lot of stuff to be doing today, but as I mentioned before, we will be talking in another hour and 40 minutes or so? Anyway, we'll be talking on republicbroadcasting.org, but I guess just in the last few minutes, what kinds of things would you like to talk about to sort of summarize what we've been talking about today?
I could really use some help. I mean, I'm up against a branch of military that I'm not in as an alleged civilian. They've stripped me of everything several times over. I'm somehow, although declared to be medically, mentally incompetent, I'm somehow forced, compelled to defend myself and act as my own counsel. I need money. I need a legal defense fund. I need people to intervene. I need people to understand the issues, not just about me, but what's going on with the Coast Guard and the bigger picture of Homeland Security and how they've literally crossed the Rubicon and are now declaring that the Coast Guard is a special branch of military in Homeland Security somehow, not in the Department of Defense, that can carry on and administer civilian affairs. That is martial law. Martial law ain't coming. It's here. It's been here since at least 2003. And that the most important thing in all of this is that the American people have, and even the people of the world, because America would not exist if it were not for the efforts of a lot of other people in a lot of other countries around the world as well. But the American people have pushed back on this time and time again before, not only in the 60s in Vietnam when the Coast Guard tried playing this and it was stripped from them and they tried to recreate these admiralty courts, but also in World War II, if not well before. And so at some point, you know, for a republic to work, for the system of by and for the people to work, for all of us to be protected individually and or collectively, it is upon the American people to act. What's the adage of all that is required for evil men to succeed is for good men, and I would add in, of course, women to do nothing.
That's unfortunately very true. So let's give people a way to act. I guess there are three ways that come to my mind. Not only monetary support, which of course is greatly needed to get legal support, but also if there are anyone out there that can provide legal support, that would obviously be helpful. And the third way would be trying to get Lieutenant Shine in touch with media figures who can help shed more light on this, like Jesse Ventura.
Well, and even doing what you're doing, and I appreciate what you are and have been doing, and even co-hosting the program that will be in just an hour and 45. But I need people to not only understand what they're – I mean, I don't know if I'm just really failing miserably at trying to get the point across of what's going on with me and how torturous it is and what this has done to me and what it would do to anyone else caught up in these type of proceedings. But it must be stopped. And not just for my own sake, but so that no one else, I would hate to see a man, woman, or child come underneath the same, you know, military tribunals that I have endured over the course of the last 8 to 9 years, with even, you know, culminating in a 4-day trial of me at one of the federal fusion centers for quote unquote allegedly being depressed, as charged against me. As think about that, I'm a civilian, and a branch of military is charging me as a civilian with being medically, mentally incompetent.
Right. I don't know if you saw, but you've mentioned the police state episode of Ventura's Conspiracy Theory a couple of times now, where they talk about the fusion centers. Have you seen that has now officially been censored, and the network has pulled it, and you can't watch it anymore? They won't be playing it anymore?
Really? Wow. Wow.
There has been apparently some government pressure applied to the production company to shelve it, and they have. It won't be played anymore.
Wow. And I've been trying to get out word about, you know, the whole stuff on the fusion centers for some time. And I guess even what Jesse exposed in there was that they've been sued several times for what, you know, for violations of constitutional rights and more. So, you know, and a lot of people don't even know they exist.
Unfortunately true, and now more people will not know because although most episodes of Conspiracy Theory have been replayed 50 or more times, this one apparently played once and will never play again.
I can't believe that they've come in and done that. Well, I hope Jesse fights that and actually gets it re-released to where it's like, you know, it does what he has to do and continues to do. I mean, that shows that what Jesse is doing. And whether you want to say he's part of the establishment and he's just stealing what everybody else has been fighting for and trying to get out here, you know, before, I believe he's doing something good by defect or default or by intent in getting it to a much broader audience.
I agree. I agree completely. I don't necessarily agree with the way he presents the information, but it's getting to more people, and I'm not territorializing information. I don't care who said what first as long as it gets out there.
Yeah, well, and I do, like, I hear what you're saying, too, to an extent. I'm not sure if this is what you're pointing to, and this is kind of where I even point a finger at Alex Jones and others to an extent, is that they kind of get, depending on how you present this information, you can discredit it. Even though you're trying to present it as if you are an advocate for it, you can do it in such a hokey, bogus, or even, you know, off on a tirade sort of way that you don't want, it's like anyone attached to it, or who's even talking about this must be crazy.
Right, exactly. So I do see that, but still, on the whole, it's getting to tens of millions of people that it would not otherwise get to. So,
and I don't think Jesse's doing it in that manner. I think he's got his own way of doing things, and he's, you know, wants to be the, it's his show, you know, and he's getting it out there. Because I always thought that if he had hired an actor, I think it would have made it more polished and less questionable. Because he is a media figure, and he is an alternative figure, somebody who has been attacked, somebody who has, you know, had a stick poked at him a few times and stuff. You know, he's not I wouldn't say he's a mainstream figure.
He's closer. Yeah, certainly not anymore, anyway. Not that, and he's been so vocal and outspoken on 9/11, where so few people have, that I have to salute him just for his courage on that issue alone.
Yeah, and I applaud him, and, you know, I hope his people and or producers get a hold of me so that hopefully I can explain and they can get this out about what's going on with Homeland Security and the Coast Guard in, you know, basically turning or creating this special branch of ever-existent military that can somehow impose itself upon civilians 24/7.
Agreed. All right. Well, I really am at the end of the time here, so just fire out the websites once again and let people know how they can get in touch.
www.martiall911.com and crossingtherubicon.org. There's also another one, lieutenanterickshine.org, or it might be lieutenantshine.org. I think it's lieutenanterickshine.org.
lterickshine.org, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and I just came across that one again that was put up a while ago and I haven't paid any attention to because, like, right now I'm writing the appeal trying to defend myself and defend everyone else out there against a branch of military that believes it can administer civilian affairs.
Right. Well, let's keep up the fight, and I guess we'll be talking to you again in just under 2 hours.
All right. Peace, guy. Take care. Thanks.
Thank you.